Yes, it's Christmas.
Christmas was on its way. Lovely, glorious, beautiful Christmas around which the entire kid year revolved.
I'm so glad you get to join us today for this show, the John Carlson Show, minus John Carlson. John's going to take a couple days off so he can get himself organized, prepared, and ready to roll.
Shopping,
Christmas
Phil.
Next week. Might be.
Shopping.
Might be some leisure. Might be some recreation in there for John as well. But John's going to be out until Thursday. He'll be back for Thursday. I am John's producer, Phil Vandervoort. You just heard the radio legend, Mark Christopher.
Good hands.
Mark and I, yes.
You're in good hands,
Mark
people.
And I are with you today, tomorrow, Wednesday. We're looking forward to it. We've got all kinds of important stuff that we're going to get to. Some of the drone stuff still is not resolved. I was confounded by some of this last week. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. Quick mention, too.
Yeah.
Mountain passes change required I-90 Snoqualmie.
Yeah.
Unless you have four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive. That just came in just seconds ago, so...
Yeah, we had the windy weather part two over the weekend. At 1,800 people.
The entire.
Were without power,
island
mostly
wide.
In the North Sound.
Island-wide, Phil, for Whidbey Island. My brother in O'Connor says.
Hammered.
You can't remember the last time the entire island was out. Average about 4 hours or longer.
Reports of 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts there, South Whidbey Island, and I think in Victoria, B.C. And then Snohomish County had power outages over the weekend as well, but... It does sound like pretty much all the power is restored, except for maybe just a few teeny tiny spots. But,
utility crews, way to go. All the long hours. Yeah. Adding to the wind, I was telling Phil before we hit the air, Crystal Mountain was clocking at 3 a.m. Saturday. Winds at 40 to 80 miles per hour at the ski resort. At about 10 a.m., they added a note on top at Rainier Express. If you've taken the scenic gondola.
The Rex.
Right up on top, they hit 101 mile per hour wind gust.
And I feel like they were... Something like that when we had the bomb cyclone happening.
Yeah.
Something close to that at Crystal, certainly up there at the peak. Not at the base, but at the peak. Yeah. The Seattle Seahawks last night, tough game against the Packers.
Sunday night.
Not one, but NBC. Two losses in the game. Hmm. Quarterback Geno Smith, ankle injury. They're trying to figure out his status. And, you know, in the frustration of the game, the Seahawks fall behind. They're kind of scrambling. They're hanging on by a fingernail. And then Geno gets injured in the second half. Backup QB guy comes in, Sam Howell. And it was clear that he was not going to be able to make anything click.
It was on fire.
I mean, the defense,
when he first came
the defense started to make some plays. And you're thinking, okay, maybe there's some hope here. But Sam Howell clearly wasn't ready last night. If he has to be called in for a starting role the next game. And I think they get the Saints, the New Orleans Saints, who are not world beaters, but winning on the road in the NFL is always tough. And the L.A. Rams, the nemesis from Los Angeles, won over the weekend. And they kind of are back in control of the NFC West because they've got tiebreakers over the Seahawks right now. So really rough situation for the Seahawks. Now, there was another big ball game over the weekend that got a lot of attention. Did you hear about the Army-Navy football game?
I have not watched that in years,
right?
And I tuned in, and I was very entertained.
I had realized, well, I mean, Army's ranked. They're in the top 20. They're number 19 in the nation.
Yeah, weren't you like 13-1
and Navy's
or something,
having
or?
A good season as well. And Navy has been pretty consistently strong the last handful of years. And so, yeah, I was doing the same thing. I said, I got to see this. I got to see the glory, the pageantry, the spectacle of the Army-Navy game because both these teams are super competitive, and that's not always the way it works out for some of the service academies because a couple of generations ago, this would have been, you know, your marquee game.
Yeah.
And Navy, the midshipmen, upset Army, somewhere Roger Staubach is smiling, and he was the NFL quarterback that was so big for the Dallas Cowboys that was a Navy guy.
Yeah.
Let's start off with what happened at the Army-Navy game with the Naval Academy choirs joining up to sing the national anthem to start the game.
Oh, save us as our Spangled banner yet has waved.
nice way to start our morning here.
And then, you know, because this is the two of the three big military academies, the stadium PA pointed out the gravity of this college ball game before kickoff.
This tradition reflects not just the spirit of competition, but the enduring ideals of our nation of selfless service, sacrifice, and commitment. And we stand in awe of these cadets and midshipmen who lay down their lives for every spectator in the stands.
These guys don't go into the transfer portal. Yeah. These guys are not looking for the next bigger, better deal.
No, they're not.
Talk about service and sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Navy wins 31-13, the upset victory over 11-1 Army.
11-1, okay.
I think, I'd have to double check.
I thought it was 13 or something.
I think Army's only loss this year was to Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Who is going to be in this college football playoff that will be a big deal.
Yeah, I keep just thinking about all the military that we have around the Puget Sound. Naval Air Station would be, JBLM, and I'm wondering, I got to believe... Everybody, you have big viewing parties for this game, mm-hmm. you know, and then when the game ended, how each, you know, the Army, they went to their crowd.
Yep.
They're singing their anthem.
And that's what's coming next.
Oh, my gosh. Just jumping in the crowd. Men and women in full uniform yep. out there in the stands. And then for the Navy as well. It put a tear in my eye. I'm like, wow, we got some power in this, in these men and women that are out there doing everything and things we don't even know or aware of that they're dealing with every day around the world.
Here are the Navy midshipmen, the ball players, and the midshipmen in uniform in the stands, all singing, I think it's, Blue and Gold, the victory song for the Naval Academy. Gold. Congratulations, Navy midshipmen. Heck of a game. They got out to an early lead and held on 31-13. So sad as the Seahawks-Packers game was for Seahawk fans, that was a pretty cool outcome for the Army-Navy game.
Did you, and real quick, too, and I saw this on the news Saturday. Last we were hearing that President-elect Donald Trump and J.D. were going Vance, to invite right? Daniel Penny.
Was in the
chokehold incident in New York to a
luxury booth with
the game.
Yeah. Speaker Mike Johnson was there.
So, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I at different points, the crowd was doing a lot of USA chants.
Yeah. So, put it on your playlist next year, and we need to just remember the date that they have that rivalry game. Well, like I said, it's been years, and I was just like, I was gripped.
Yeah. I would like to go see a ball game at West Point. Up upstate New York. I would just, it doesn't have to be the Army Navy game. They always do that one at a bigger venue anyway. So I think they did this last one at Meadowlands.
And we always
New
say
Jersey's
we're not a sports station, news
stadium.
talk radio, yeah. But you know, we see things that affect people and just want to put it in the spotlight. And that was one definite positive and feel good about America moment.
That would be
on
a
Saturday.
A mini bucket list type item, see a ball game at West Point, the Naval Academy, or pardon me, the Army Academy. And seeing one in Annapolis on the Navy Academy campus wouldn't be a horrible idea either, but something about upstate New York seems kind of...
I've been just thinking,
well, I've never been up that way before.
And I was just thinking, too, when you see these two teams between the Army and the Navy, I mean, where is home base? Where do they do practice? Does everybody leave all their assignment bases? And
I'm sure they got practice.
And they have to go somewhere for the entire fall to play football and then come back on duty when you're done with this game and all the bowl games.
I think they've got that going on. Well, in for John Carlson this morning, that's Mark Christopher. I'm Phil Vandervoort. John's just taking a couple days off, planned absence. He'll be back at the end of the week. And I do have lots of politics that I want to get to. We're going to dig into some of these presidential Biden commutations. And a couple of them are pardons, but a lot of them are commutations. And you heard the headline of 1,500 commutations. But did you get any of the fine print about whose sentences were commuted? Because there's some problems with some of the decisions Biden made. I know we're still trying to keep track and making sure that we don't miss anything as it relates to the assassination of the United Healthcare CEO and the arrest and still waiting pending charges, at least in New York, for the murder of the United Healthcare CEO and the suspect, Luigi Mangione. But one of the things I want to get to is whether or not, we'll do this a little bit later in the show, something we're to preview right now, is if there are, if this assassination is going to prompt a larger examination of what does or does not happen with healthcare in the United States, if we're, are we going to get any quantifiable reforms out of this, or will this just fade into the background when the next news crisis or the next crisis that becomes a news story crops up, and will we forget about all of this? So I've got some thoughts on that. Because I get the strong feeling that Democrats are going to try and keep pushing the subject of the United Healthcare CEO's assassination to beat the drum of Medicare for all or universal healthcare. So I've got some thoughts that I want to get into on that. But right now, let's take some time to get back. Oh, and one other thing that I want to get to in the next segment when we do the social media. You just heard the national anthem at the Army-Navy game. I've got the national anthem where a 96-year-old World War II veteran played a musical instrument for the crowd, and the crowd went absolutely bonkers. And it was at a professional sporting event over the weekend. But if you want to hear the 96-year-old World War II veteran playing harmonica and the national anthem, I'll do that in the next segment when we get to the social media suite. But like I said, last week you heard about all these reports of President Biden commuting 1,500 sentences, and that turned out to be the biggest such presidential commutation in presidential U.S. history. Now, no doubt you heard about some of the people whose sentences were commuted, but some stem from a judicial bribery scandal that was connected to a for-profit juvenile jail. And of course, we've got this dilemma here in King County in the state of Washington of not trying to put anybody into a juvenile jail. And what President Biden did involves a couple of people that were convicted. And Jim Garrity from National Review, he's got the goods. He's got the receipts on all of this. And he writes, we're going to examine the shameless crooks that Biden let out early. Biden's monstrous pardons are what Jim Garrity writes at National Review. In the statement released by the White House, the president announced the commutation of 1,499 sentences, 39 pardons. According to the White House statement, America was built on the promise of possibility and second chances. As president, I have the great privilege of extending mercy to people who have demonstrated remorse and rehabilitation, restoring opportunity for Americans to participate in daily life and contribute to their communities. And Garrity points out, hey, no doubt there's a place for pardons and things like that for someone who broke the law when they were young but have now benefited from knowledge and experience. And deserve that pardon. But Garrity writes, meet some of the beneficiaries of Biden's mercy. And he writes, unless you live near Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, you've never heard of the Kids for Cash scandal. So I'm going to explain what was going on with this. And I've got to double check the years. The sentencing came up in 2011. So this had been going on throughout the early part of the 2000s. In this part of Pennsylvania. 72-year-old Michael Conahan was convicted along with a former judge, Mark Ciavarella, of funneling juvenile defendants to two private, for-profit juvenile jails, detention centers, in exchange for $2.1 million in kickbacks. So the for-profit company builds a jail. Like, we want to get offenders into the jail. So now they're bribing judges to make sure that the judges issue long sentences and don't do diversion and all of these other options that could be on the table in a criminal court proceeding for a juvenile. Conahan pleaded guilty to racketeering conspiracy charges, was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison in 2011. So we're 13 years into 17 odd years of a sentence. However, he petitioned the courts for compassionate release back during the COVID pandemic, writing that he was in grave danger of not only contracting the virus, but of dying from the virus. And he was released to home confinement in Florida under federal supervision back in June 2020 amid the COVID crisis. And Jim Garrity writes, Sandy Fonzo, who famously confronted Schiavarella outside federal court over the suicide of her son after he was placed in a juvenile detention center as part of this bribery arrangement, called the development deeply painful when that judge, or I guess that guy in the racketeering, got the home detention. So the mother, whose son was sent to this for-profit detention center as part of this bribery kickback scheme, she said about this, I am shocked and I am hurt. Conahan's actions destroyed families, including mine, and my son's suicide death is a tragic reminder of the consequences of his abuse of power. This pardon feels like an injustice for all of us who still suffer. Right now, I am processing and doing the best I can to cope with the pain that this has brought back. And as Jim Garrity writes, these guys took bribes, sent kids to for-profit juvenile prisons with sentences disproportionate to their crimes, all as part of this kickback scheme. And one of the juveniles that was ordered and sentenced to this detention center ended up committing suicide later. But these are a couple of the people that Joe Biden has commuted the sentences of. You didn't hear that in the headlines last week, did you? So Jim Garrity adding all that information in there. And then here's another one. This one goes to the 17-year-old that I just mentioned that committed suicide. Yasser Ali is a writer for Huffington Post, but he's a lot like Glenn Greenwald or Barry Weiss, those more liberal-leaning writers that have, I think, a lot of intellectual credibility with what they write. Ali points out, there are so many heartbreaking stories of kids whose lives were ruined by this judge in Pennsylvania. One example, Edward Kenzakoski, 17-year-old at the time, he was a competitive wrestler, got charged with a minor drug paraphernalia offense, had no prior criminal record. The judge, because of this kickback scheme, bribery scandal, sentenced him to spend months in private lockups and a wilderness camp. He ended up missing his senior year of high school as a result. He came out of lockup an understandably angry and depressed young man. His friends and family said he was never the same. It was a few years later, when he was 23 years old, that he committed suicide. So you almost have these two extremes. Here in King County, we have zero youth detention, and we want to make everything go through one of these restorative justice programs, and we've seen that that's not working. And then you have this kickback scheme that was exposed in Pennsylvania where they wanted to lock juveniles up for as long as possible because this for-profit youth detention center was giving money to judges to get longer sentences so they'd have juveniles in custody longer. And neither one of those systems is even remotely reasonable or smart. So there's two extremes right there, but that's the problem with going to extremes. All righty.
How many total now that pardons her for President
Well, Biden? The pardons were the low number. It was the commutation of sentences was 1,499.
Okay.
So that's where you serve some time, we're just going to call it good, and you're going to get to go free. So
I was looking at some of the records of the U.S. Department of Justice office. They're saying right now, up to date, for one-term president, we had Herbert Hoover at 1,385, and this pardon of the U.S. Department of Justice office program dates back to the 1900s. So it looks like we might have a new record established here.
Mm-hmm. So that's the Biden record as of last week. All righty. Coming up next, we'll get to the social media sweep, and then I'll talk more about, hey, if are we going to get quantifiable reforms in healthcare as a result of the assassination of the United Healthcare CEO, or will this scandal crisis pass? What will Democrats do? We'll get into that as well coming up next. And then at 6:50 this morning, we'll talk to Lars Larson. Lars Larson will jump in with me. And I got to talk to Lars about how many undercover FBI informants were at the January 6th riot that turned into an attack on the Capitol. So those are some of the things that are coming up as Mark Christopher and I, Phil Vandervoort, sit in for John Carlson on KVI. A couple of days off. He'll be back Thursday. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort, along with Mark Christopher. Let's get to the social media sweep. Sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort over in Bellevue. They're doing the Snowflake Lane, downtown Bellevue stuff. Turned out some pro-Hamas activists showed up. What do you think happened? Yeah, probably exactly what you think. So the typical clamor and sound and fury. And Jonathan Cho, digital journalist, he captured a little bit of what was going on. I'll play a little moment of what Jonathan Cho posted with these activists. And they're going after the shipping company Maersk. If you're ever down near Harbor Island, the Seattle waterfront, you'll see the big shipping cargo containers go back and forth out of the port. Maersk, M-A-E-R-S-K is the big shipping company. And just like they've gone after Boeing and Microsoft, now they're going after Maersk.
Maersk directly supports the ongoing genocide of our people.
Hey, Santa, what do you think about these pro-Hamas protesters?
So there's Jonathan Cho. He walks up to a guy in the Santa outfit there at Snowflake Lane. Here's Santa.
They're trying to wreck your day.
Yeah, they are definitely.
They are definitely, said the Santa Claus with the pro-Hamas protesters. So that was what just happened there. Now, also, I mentioned in the last segment, the Army-Navy football game and the national anthem we did. There was another national anthem performance in New York City, and it was at an NBA game for the New York Knicks, and 96-year-old World War II veteran Pete Dupre played the national anthem on the harmonica, and the crowd really seemed to love it. Check it out. And on that last note, he doffs his cap. His cap says World War II vet, America on it. 96-year-old Pete Dupre there. That was at an NBA ball game over the weekend.
Good full win, too, in that harmonica. I mean, even hitting some of those high notes and not taking a breath. Because sometimes you hear that in a harmonica player.
Yeah, so a very cool moment for that 96-year-old World War II veteran. Okay, up next as we sit in for John Carlson here on KVI, Mark and I are going to get into this whole drone story. Drone sightings in Oregon, New York, New Jersey, all kinds of other places. Are people confused? Do people actually know what a drone is when it's in the sky? Because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's going on here. We'll try and get to the bottom of this, sort out the actual stuff from the inactual stuff. We'll do that next here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. All righty. Thanks, Chipmunks. Hi, everybody. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, along with Mark Christopher, in for John this morning. John's going to be off the next couple of days, but he'll be back on Thursday and Friday. Thank you for sticking with us this morning. We've got so much to cover. Lars Larson will be along in a couple of minutes. I got to ask Lars about this story that came out late last week that there were 26 FBI informants inside the January 6th crowd. I think first and foremost, there's a Doge joke in there somewhere, but we'll get to that with Lars in a couple minutes. Right now, we got to take a couple of minutes to talk about what in the heck is happening with all this drone chatter. New York, New Jersey, there's drones flying all over. And I thought that this would probably get resolved in some reasonable way, and then now people are posting video of what they think are drones. And I think this is the big problem here, is that just because somebody has a camera on their phone and the ability to post video to the internet, take your pick on social media platform that you like, all of a sudden video of just about anything is getting posted. I've seen a couple of these that have ended up on newscasts. And if you look at them closely, it's very clear that's not a drone. That's a plane. Well, now, there are some others. these videos that are surfacing that are, you know, tough to make out. Either the resolution's not very good, but I think that there's just a jump to a conclusion. Oh, wow, I saw a drone too.
And you'll see satellites. I mean, how many times do, seriously, people, how many times do we actually look up? But now all of a sudden we have something that gives us reason to look up, and maybe you're seeing things in the sky you just didn't realize. How many satellites we have going overhead. Again, SeaTac with extra runways. We got planes landing up at Payne Field. So they're at a little higher altitude over Seattle, and we have some clear skies at one point over the weekend. So
let's give you a little scene setter of how this came together in news reports over the weekend. We'll start with this. It's from a WJLA Washington, D.C. reporter. And it starts off with a clip of Chris Christie, the former New Jersey governor, because so much of this revolved around videos in New Jersey, in the New Jersey, New York area. So you're going to hear Chris Christie's voice, and then it's going to go through some of the other observations of what has been reported to this point about so many of these drone flights or unknown drones.
To say this is not unusual activity, it's just wrong. I lived in New Jersey my whole life. This is the first time that I've noticed drones over my house.
But the Department of Homeland Security and FBI insisted in a statement there is no national security threat, writing many of the reported sightings are actually manned aircraft.
So that goes to what I was just mentioning, that if you look at some of these, it's very clearly that's a plane. And because you have a cell phone and you can hit the record button on the video and then you can upload that to the internet and you make that post, just because you think it's a drone doesn't automatically make it a drone. And so that's one of the problems here. Let's continue.
Operating lawfully. The sightings have expanded to Maryland. Former Governor Larry Hogan posting this video, calling the government's response entirely unacceptable.
Okay. Members of Congress will return to Capitol Hill this week, but their prime focus will be passing a spending bill and avoiding a government shutdown. Meanwhile, the authority given to the FBI and the DHS to deal with those drones is set to expire on December 20th.
So we've got that conundrum for Congress to deal with in a much more timely manner. Now, a couple of items related to all of this drone chatter. You remember a couple of months ago, John Carlson, maybe it was mid-November, so not quite a couple of months ago, but 4 or 5 weeks ago. And in New York, wildlife officials went into some guy's house because he had been trying to do wild animal rescues with squirrels and things like that. And maybe I'm trying to remember if a raccoon was part of it. And they had to euthanize the squirrel. And the squirrel became this symbol of government just going too far and intruding on this guy who was trying to do wildlife rehabilitation for some of these little critters. Somebody pointed out, hey, this is all happening with the drones around New York and New Jersey, so they can't shoot down unregistered drones, but they can kill a man's squirrel and kill a raccoon in his own home without due process. So there's an example of the internet never forgets.
That's a good point.
From just a month ago.
Major networks, of course, television.
For what the state tells us, well, we're not going to be able to handle this.
Yeah, the address on the drones, I just want to do a quick update right now here. Authorities have been seeking out the drone operators who might be violating the law in some areas there in the Northeast. In fact, I just heard this weekend, two people in Boston were arrested for operating drones near Logan Airport.
And that's the big international airport in Boston.
And then, Phil, everybody's wondering about the Northwest.
An Oregon story.
Right, an Oregon story, and some people were saying, well, no, there's been some other drones. There's got to be copycats. We have a lot of drone pilots here in the Northwest. Proof of that is when we do the Boeing Seafair Air Shows. You know, I'm in the announcer, and one of the things I have to reveal is, everybody, if you got a drone, don't fly it anywhere near the race course on Lake Washington. Of course, if you do that, we have to cancel whatever the next act is for a performer, because, of course, you get high-speed jets flying through there from JBLM and Naval Air Station would be. But a life flight pilot says he witnessed bizarre behavior from mysterious lights in the sky after multiple reports over Western Oregon about a week ago. Joe Bewley was flying, or actually he's been flying as a pilot since 2013. He's got 6,000 recorded hours of flight time, but he said he's never seen anything like what he saw. Video taken by Life Flight crew members appears to show an orange dot on a screen that constantly fades in and out. Now, Bewley saying that he couldn't really identify it. This was on December 7th, so we're talking just over a week ago here. Now, the FAA saying in a statement, quote, a pilot reported seeing unidentified lights while flying in what's called the Seattle Air Route Traffic Control Center airspace And this again, Saturday, December 7th. Here's the FAA.
It was registering like an aircraft. So the weird thing is we were seeing it as an aircraft inside the aircraft, but ATC wasn't showing it on their radar.
No explanation. Still an identified flying drone of sort.
Yeah. I would say that there's an Occam's razor in here somewhere, that the simplest answer is the most likely answer. Like last week I heard Lars's show when some of this was first cropping up, and it was mostly still focused around New York and New Jersey then. And there was some chatter that, you know, this could be the Iranians that managed to get these drones all the way across the Atlantic Ocean on a ship of some kind and then launched from a ship off the coast of New York and New Jersey and then got them into continental airspace from being offshore. And I thought to myself, wait a second, is this the same Iran that funds Hezbollah that had no clue that pagers were about to explode in Hezbollah people's pants? And they didn't have that expertise, and they didn't have expertise to stop the assassination of one of their top government officials inside his own home, because that was another story that happened in Iran here a couple of months ago between the Iran-Hamas slash Israel battles. But yet they've got enough military expertise that they can get the drones, they can get them on a ship, they can get the ship all the way off the coast of the United States in the Atlantic Ocean from Iran, and then they can get these drones into U.S. airspace. Like, come on. I don't think that that's a likely outcome for what's going on with these either unidentified drone videos or these reports of, hey, here's another mysterious drone. Yeah, wait, the most likely answer is the simplest answer.
Well, the grocery store conversation, too, people are saying, how come we don't just shoot one down? Is NORAD involved, you know, keeping track of all the airspace around the U.S., and you think, well, a drone's too small. I mean, Naval Air Station would be years ago. I saw, you know, they didn't take me into it because it's very high, let's say, you know, secure facility, but they can actually keep track of whales in the oceans.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
All over.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, can't we just capture a drone or maybe take one down and find out what it is and go from there, yes. But people still wonder, like, no, we shall see.
But I think a lot of this can be chalked up to a little bit of internet hysteria. So I don't think it's quite the crisis that everyone wants to make it out to be, or that there's this grand conspiracy. The most likely answer is going to be the simplest answer. All righty. Guess who's coming up next?
Holy smokes, it was 6:45. Only one thing in the world could have dragged me away from the soft glow of electric sex gleaming in the window.
All right, another Christmas story reference there for everybody. Lars Larson is going to jump in next. So the report I got to ask Lars about is how many FBI undercover informants were at the January 6th rally turned attack on the Capitol. And we have to talk about that with Lars. That's something that we'll do up next. And then coming up at 7:35, stick around. Make sure you're here because we're all wondering what in the world is going on with this long-term care payroll tax that we are all forced to pay into in the sense that we would potentially be able to cash in on some long-term care coverage for our elder years. But there are a couple of Republicans down in the state legislature in Olympia that are going to be offering up some tweaks, some fixes, some improvements to the Jay Inslee long-term care payroll tax scheme. And they're going to have an uphill battle in the Olympia legislature because Democrats are in the majority. But I will speak to one of the Republican state representatives who wants to try and see if he can force the Democrats' hand with some changes that would make that long-term care payroll tax a whole lot more beneficial for a whole lot more people. So that is something that we will do as we sit in for John Carlson at 7:34 this morning. So lots of reasons for you to stick around. The most immediate one is coming up next with KVI's midday host, Lars Larson. I'm Phil Vandervoort, along with Mark Christopher here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Every day from noon to 3 on Talk Radio 570 KVI, you hear KVI's Lars Larson, and Lars joins us now on John Carlson's show as I sit in for John this morning. Lars, this story caught my attention for a couple of different reasons, and I had a feeling it would resonate with you as well, but it was disclosed late last week that the FBI had 26 confidential informants at the January 6th, 2021 rally slash riot slash attack on the Capitol. And knowing about kind of how everything developed there, that the FBI had people that were there to observe and then probably report back to FBI officials, this bothered me on a couple of different aspects. For starters, did the FBI plug in any confidential informants to any of the defund police or various riots that happened in cities from Minneapolis to Portland, to pick your other cities? Do we have any reports about those sorts of things that the FBI felt the need to use human confidential informants kind of undercover, essentially, in these large gatherings?
No, they did not. And here's something else.
Attacks.
With those people on the ground, if you're in the middle of a big mob of people, how much can you actually observe except about the people immediately around you? I've been in those big crowds as a reporter before. It's tough. Now, that's number one. Number two, are you there? Are you allowing those people to be instigators of what happened on January 6th? We all know the example of Ray Epps, who had a relationship with the FBI, also was admired by many people in that crowd, himself encouraging people to go into the Capitol, but then he never did. So what I've always wondered is, was the FBI using these confidential human sources to go in and instigate what happened on January 6th? I think there's a setup there. And how far ahead did the FBI know? I'll tell you that on January the 9th, there was an FBI press conference that was broadcast nationally, and the FBI said, we warned the Capitol Police days ahead of time that there was trouble coming. Well, hold on a second. You knew days ahead. Well, they arrested Enrique Terrio at the airport, you know, one of the members of the Proud Boys, 3 days before January 6th because he was carrying a gun magazine in his luggage, an empty one. And you say, well, okay, so you knew things were coming at you, and then you put a bunch of people in the crowd that were not your W-2 employee FBI agents, but were, in fact, working on your behalf.
Undercover informants. Now,
were they there to gather information or to instigate what happened?
Let me throw another one at you.
Sure.
With President-elect Trump and Vivek Ramaswamy, Elon Musk leading the DOGE effort, Department of Government Efficiency, could we say that some of those 26 undercover FBI informants could be evaluated by DOGE and maybe we cut back to just six? Can we cut back to maybe 5 instead of 26? Is that a place where DOGE could be looking to make some changes?
And what are you allowed to do with those people? Because I've had lots of conversations with attorneys over the years and said, if the police are forbidden by the Constitution to do something like an unwarranted search, can they send somebody else in to do it on their behalf? The minute you've sent them in to do something you're not allowed to do, they are acting as your agent.
The fruit of the poison tree, I believe, as lawyers say, right? And then there's the irony that nobody in the defund police circles from a couple of years ago is complaining about the news that came out last week that, hey, look, the FBI has all these paid informants. They seem to be comfortable with that, or at least their silence would indicate that they're comfortable with that. So there's another oddity about this report that came out last week about the FBI undercover agents of January 6th. Lars Larson.
Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah. That's next week with Christmas. It coincides a little bit this year.
We want to add change required I-90 here. All vehicles, unless you got four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, and of course oversized loads restricted. Highway 2, traction advised there over Stevens Pass. Oversized loads still restricted there too, Phil, but that might be the better way to go if you need to get on the road and go east right now.
And I think tomorrow is really when it's going to take off and snow a lot.
Yeah.
My understanding of the forecast.
Somebody at Snoqualmie tomorrow. Looks like pass holders are going to open their ski season here. That gives you an indication how much snow we're getting up at the summit there at Snoqualmie.
It's starting to happen, yes. Hi, everybody. That's Mark Christopher, the radio legend. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, and we're sitting in for John this morning. John's going to take a couple days off to start the week. Just a planned thing he wanted to do. He'll be back to end the week and start next week. So Mark and I will handle things on the morning show today, tomorrow, Wednesday. And we'll get back with John Carlson on Thursday here. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, please stick with me. If you are concerned about any of the initiatives on the November ballot, the three that did not pass, one of those was Initiative 2124. It would have made the long-term care payroll tax scheme to require forced participation. Well, it still does require the forced participation. It would have made it opt-in. Would have kept the program. Wouldn't have changed much. Would have just allowed people that didn't feel the need, didn't see the return on investment, so to speak, of being forced to pay 58 cents on every $100 you make in payroll into this state insurance program, which, I mean, we have plenty of private insurance programs that are out there and available for people. Why does the state need to get involved in this industry? It is beyond me. It's obviously unnecessary, but that's not the mentality of the people in the majority control of the legislature down in Olympia. It's certainly not the attitude of Governor Inslee. They want to require us to be paying into something that supports a state government program with this payroll tax. Well, a state lawmaker down in Centralia, Chehalis area, Peter Abarno, a state rep, Republican, he's going to join me at 7:35, and we're going to talk about plans that the Republicans have to offer up some fixes, some tweaks, some changes to this long-term care payroll tax that is supposed to go for long-term health care coverage when you're in dire need, probably in your older years. So that'll happen coming up here at the bottom of the hour, 7:34 here, 7:35 on the commute with Carlson. The story continues about the murder and assassination of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. And I've got a couple of items I want to bring up about that story because that still, you know, is either dominating the headlines or is dominating people's attention about what is happening with this story. We're still kind of waiting to hear some stronger, more detailed reports about motivation in this killing. If we've got the suspect that's in custody right now and is still waiting to be charged in New York for the murder of Brian Thompson, the UnitedHealthcare CEO, that's the suspect, Luigi Mangione. But a couple of stories that relate to this, one of them came out on Friday, and it was the UnitedHealth Group CEO. So this is the larger umbrella group that UnitedHealthcare is under. And the UnitedHealthcare Group, UnitedHealthcare was the smaller subsidiary, I guess, or smaller branch of UnitedHealth Group. That group CEO, his name is Andrew Witty. And last week, in the wake of Brian Thompson's murder and assassination and the news about the arrest of the suspect, Andrew Witty acknowledged that the U.S. healthcare system is flawed and is in need of reform. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times. It's really the first public comments for the UnitedHealth Group CEO to comment on the assassination of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. So hopefully I've explained that distinction between their two positions correctly. UnitedHealth Group CEO Andrew Witty said that the company, together with employers, governments, and other payers, rate payers, needs to improve how insurers explain what is covered and how those decisions are made. Now, I wanted to bring all this up because I wondered if the murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson would actually spur any significant quantifiable reforms, or are we just going to end up with the status quo and another crisis comes up? This is just part and parcel of the American political news attention span. It's a function of the news cycle. A new story comes up, all the coverage gets devoted to a new story. Previous stories just basically disappear from coverage, disappear from the headlines. So I bring this up because the progressive left in Congress, I'm pretty sure, is going to keep hitting on this story, the assassination of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, Brian Thompson, and they're going to keep bringing this up in a push for either Medicare for all or single-payer universal health care. But I want to sound the alarm that those promises are not what they're going to be cracked up to be. You're going to get what you pay for. And that's part of the problem with insurance. If we have all the costs that are associated with running hospitals, and we hear occasionally the stories about, oh, I paid $16 for a couple of Tylenol or ibuprofen or something like that, something that should be costing pennies instead of dollars, that's one of the problems here. And far too oftentimes when it comes to insurance, the hospitals, the medical providers end up having an opportunity to scale up the cost of what they're charging. That's obviously going to be a factor that does need addressing and accountability. But this idea that we're going to think we get better results out of a government-run program? Look around. Name me one government program that's working well right now, state level, federal level, and there may be two that I can think of. One would be military operations, and I'll give you the stipulation, costs notwithstanding. How about FAA overseeing airplane flights and safety? That seems to work pretty well. But outside of that, I don't know that there are any sterling examples of state government-run, federal government-run programs that you'd say, you know what, that's good enough for me. I'd like to apply that to my medical health care coverage. So one other example I would like, because I want to try and come up with solutions. I want to be solutions-oriented here. And one of the things that I think can go a long way towards creating valuable, reasonable medical health care coverage is a tax break incentive. So if your company is offering health care coverage to your employees, use the tax break, the federal tax system, use a tax break as incentive. And if you offer health care to your employees in an employer-employee private market health care situation, you get a tax break. And use that as an incentive to get the employers to start providing medical health care coverage to employees. And I think that that would be a great incentive to try and get those employers to offer that up. And then that becomes a bonus for the people that they're trying to attract and they're trying to hire. So that's one of the things that I think is going on here. And then there's this other interview clip that I came across from Fox News, Fox Business News, actually, to be specific. Charles Payne, who does a lot of great stuff on the Fox Business Channel. And he had a guest on that kind of was talking about all of this lionization and praise of Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old assassination murder suspect of the United Healthcare CEO. And his guest was from the Boston Globe. This is a conservative newspaper in the city of Boston. She's one of the opinion writers. She's an editorial board member. But she was on with Charles Payne on Fox Business News, and she pointed out something that I think has a direct connection to how, and we'll kind of define it at least loosely, as Generation Z. The kids that are probably 30 years old to 50-odd years old, somewhere in there. That's basically your Gen Z as opposed to your millennials. Your millennials are kind of up to the late 20s right now. So Generation Z, late 20s to 50s or late 40s. And listen to what this writer, her name's Corinne Hajjar, listen to what she said about the middle-aged people who are indicating their support for Luigi Mangione as it relates to the accusation that he is the one that allegedly murdered the United Healthcare CEO.
It's an activist generation, and I think that in a lot of cases this year, we've seen activism just go too far, whether it's anti-capitalist activism like this last instance, or if we're talking about posters, what about ripping down posters of hostages held in Gaza? I mean, it is just an activist generation that will say or do anything to justify their ideology.
Wow. There's a lot of accuracy in what she's saying. And when she started down that path, I mean, the thing that jumped out at me is what created this level of activism amongst Gen Z, people that are 30 now into their 30s and their 40s, that might brush aside the just flat out right from wrong murder of another human being to justify their viewpoints about what might be right or wrong with healthcare coverage in America. And the one that I think has been going on the longest is climate change and how much climate change hysteria has gone on since the early 2000s. And you've got a guy like Jay Inslee.
The time is up. Our house is on fire.
The fuse has been burning for decades, and now the climate change bomb has gone off.
And so it did start with some of the climate change rhetoric. And then it's kind of morphed into a little bit of the defund police rhetoric. And then in the clip that you just heard from Karine Hajjar, it's manifested itself as well in the pro-Hamas activism that we've seen. And that goes to, you know, the millennial generation. So all of this is adding up.
It's an activist generation, and I think that in a lot of cases this year, we've seen activism just go too far, whether it's anti-capitalist activism like this last instance, or if we're talking about posters, what about ripping down posters of hostages?
And those are starting to go hand in hand. Last hour on the show, I played the clip from what Jonathan Cho, digital reporter, posted over in Bellevue with the pro-Hamas activists trying to interrupt the Snowflake Lane operation there in Bellevue.
Well, look how
near
fast.
Bellevue Square, and they're tying it to corporations Boeing, like Microsoft.
Again, I can't help but think here with the news headline, Phil, and what we heard at the top of the hour here on KVI here, since the gunning down of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, December 4th. You know, here we are today as December 16th.
16, yeah.
GoFundMe is already yanking any and all campaigns, apparently quite a few, supporting Luigi Mangione, the so-called shooter, as donations continue to pour online platforms. And there was one private one already where they said at the top of the hour had already collected $100,000. The other thing is it reminds me back when, you know, Black Lives Matter was really kicking in gear. Mm-hmm. And I was hearing younger people, and oh, I'm going to donate. And I'm like, verify where you're donating, because again, you can donate, feel good about what you do, but who's to say somebody's not just collecting the money and suddenly it goes away, like we saw with Black Lives Matter, and just it went into somebody's pocket and it didn't do anything. But again, look how serious this is. Talk about activists with GoFundMe saying, no more campaigns. No, not for Luigi Mangione. This is not a good thing here right now, they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really disheartening that people can get, especially in that age group, get sucked into this mentality that the hysteria either leads them to believe that they can condone this or more directly support it. It's just it's very sad development that there isn't more critical thinking going on, particularly among some of these younger age brackets. So, pray for the best, prepare for the worst, I guess, is kind of what we're seeing there. But
just like the election, do your research. You know, don't just go with one thing, somebody said this and somebody said this, or a celebrity I love said this.
Oh, sure.
And then you find out maybe that celebrity was paid.
Yeah.
And but I feel like, again, just do your research like we all do and make your own decision. That's a great thing about America, Phil.
Yeah. Ari,
make your own decision. That's Ari, what your right is.
Ari, the afternoon host here, Ari Hoffman from 3 to 6 on KVI, and he has summed it up, I think, by using this term social currency. You know, it's cool amongst these age groups and these demographics, these younger demographics. It's cool to be in line with some of this stuff.
And no doubt.
If it's the keffiyeh, wearing the keffiyeh, or being pro-Hamas, not understanding the relationship between Hamas and Israel and Jewish people and things like that. So
go back to when we were kids here. You know, you listen to mom and dad's conversations with neighbors and friends and relatives about politics and elections and issues in the community. Then you get to school. Somebody bring it up in class. Maybe the teacher says, okay, kids, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, hello cell phone, hello online, hello chat, TikTok. You have so many sources, all this electronic media over the top that, again, some good, some bad. That's where you really got to use your filter on a lot of this stuff.
Critical thinking. Challenge. Nothing a little critical thinking couldn't help here as we continue to talk politics on Talk Radio 570 KVI. In for John Carlson this morning, I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. That's Mark Christopher, the radio legend, up next. We're going to hit the social media sweep. I've got a recreation of an interview with the King County executive, Dow Constantine, that I think you might enjoy. So we'll do that recreation here in just a moment. And at the bottom of the hour, we're going to try and see if we can get some answers on whether or not there can be some reasonable fixes in the Olympia legislature to the long-term care payroll tax that we're forced to participate in. And this all relates to the failed vote on Initiative 2124 that Washington voters just didn't understand, didn't know what they were voting on to the extent that they could have made it opt-in. They didn't have to cancel the program. They just could have made it opt-in, but they voted the other direction on that. So those are a couple of the next things we're going to do here as we sit in for Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. That's a peppy number.
Got to play a little bit of the Elf soundtrack. It's been on TV so many times already.
Oh, is that one from Elf? Okay.
Just a walk in the park, like we are doing for Mr. Carlson today, Phil.
John Carlson's taking today, tomorrow, and Wednesday off. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort, sitting in along with Mark Christopher, the radio legend, right there, spinning the Christmas tunes. And thank you for sticking with us. In a couple minutes, we're going to get a guest on from the Washington State Legislature, Republican State Representative from, I got to double check the bio, but I believe it's Centralia, Chehalis area. But the bill that's being pre-filed would fix, tweak, amend, improve the long-term care payroll tax that we're all paying into. Unless we already purchased our own personal plan, this forced participation that Governor Inslee and the legislative Democrats got everybody into. So we'll talk about that here in about 8-9 more minutes as the show continues. But right now, the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Brian Haywood, who put together some of those statewide initiatives, he recreated a conversation with the King County executive Dow Constantine on social media. He posted his conversation recreation. And this goes to something John Carlson talked about on the show last week. And this was a question and answer written interview that the group Future 42 did with Dow Constantine about, wait, what are some demonstrable things that we know we have accomplished as it relates to getting people out of homelessness in King County? We've got the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. We know that that's been the big response by King County and to some extent state government for how do we improve, how do we stop homelessness, how do we get people off the streets. So Brian Haywood recreated a conversation based on what was discovered in the Future 42 interview last week. It goes like this. How much money has King County spent on ineffective homeless programs? Answer, nobody knows. How many people have been lifted out of homelessness because of King County's spending? Answer, nobody knows. When will we have numbers and accountability? Answer, nobody knows. When will we see results that actually work? Answer, nobody knows. Why did the number of homeless people, despite all this spending, rise from 10,000 to roughly 16,000? Answer, nobody knows. And do you think your efforts have been a success? And again, that question asked of King County Executive Dow Constantine. Do you think your efforts have been a success? Answer, oh, absolutely. So that really puts it in perspective. We don't have any quantifiable answers about how much money has been spent, how many people have been helped. And then, of course, we know that homelessness is not getting better. It's getting worse materially. And the answer from the King County Executive's office is, well, yeah, this is the thing to do. Not worrying about any metrics whatsoever. And Democrats will tell you that they're the party of science. And science works off metrics. And science works off proof, right? Okay. Brandy Cruz, she had a great discovery. She found a job listing, and I believe it's for the state government. It's a medical specialist. Oh, let's double check. It's in Thurston County, so it's a county position, not a state position. But Brandy found this job posting for a gender-affirming medical specialist. A physician 3 is the job code classification. Thurston County, Tumwater, Washington, full-time permanent employment, between $198,000 and $267,000 annual salary, category in the Physicians Allied Health Health Sciences for the Department of Corrections. So not necessarily public health or anything like that, but through the Department of Corrections. And the job description is gender-affirming medical specialist, health services division headquarters. And it was posted 1 week ago. And as Brandy points out, Democrats in Washington state can claim they have no choice but to raise your taxes because we're facing a massive budget deficit. Meanwhile, the state just posted a job opening for a gender-affirming medical specialist to provide care to transgender prison inmates that could pay up to $267,000 a year.
What a heck of a start for such a position.
Great catch by Brandy. So the host of the Undivided podcast, frequent guest between John Carlson, Ari Hoffman, our afternoon host, 3 to 6. But, boy, great catch by Brandy. Phil Vandervoort, Mark Christopher sitting in for John Carlson here. We're going to get into what's happening with the long-term care roll, long-term care payroll tax here in our state. And we're going to interview a state representative in the legislature coming up next about that. Starting off the week, wet and windy, and most of the wind is tapered off, I guess. It was windy over the weekend, but the wet part's going to continue kind of off and on all week. I think we're going to get some wind back later in the week as well.
Snow at 3,000 feet, change required, Snoqualmie.
Yeah.
All vehicles, unless you got four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive.
Snow level is going to rise a little bit Wednesday, Thursday, and then it's going to be raining up in the Cascades on top of that snow. So that's a little bit of what we're looking at weather-wise. As we kick off on Monday, I'm John Carlson's producer, Phil Vandervoort, sitting in for John Carlson. Mark Christopher, the radio legend there with me. Got a guest on the phone line here from the state legislature down in Olympia. And he's Republican state rep Peter Abarno. And Representative Abarno, thank you for jumping on to talk to us this morning about the long-term care payroll tax in the state.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pre-filing is what's kind of happening right now with the legislative session going to start in January. And you and another state representative from Colfax, another Republican, are working on a couple of bills that you want to get action on that would fix some shortcomings with, it's called the Washington Cares Program. That's the name of it. But the practical impact is what I just referenced, this long-term care payroll tax. Everyone pays in if you didn't already obtain your own long-term care private health insurance coverage. You get forced into this state program. And it was up for a vote on the November ballot in the form of Initiative 2124 that would have made this requirement, this forced participation, an opt-in. So now you've filed one bill that would kind of go back to the beginning of how this Washington Cares program got installed. What would House Bill 1025 do that you've pre-filed in the legislature?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So of the two bills I filed, the first one was 1025, and it would allow for a one-year opt-out. It's in recognition of the fact that a half a million Washington workers opted out of the Washington Cares payroll tax program, and many more wanted to and were unable to. And, you know, despite the, you know, $14 million spent against the initiative, there are still a lot of people who find major flaws in this program from all walks of life and from all angles. Even the Seattle Times called this program a deeply flawed program. So I think 1025 creates a one-time opt-out in recognition that this is going to be a permanent program. You know, it gives people one more chance to find a long-term care program that fits their family, not the cookie cutter program the state created.
I gotcha. So if I understand it correctly, it sort of creates a bit of a do-over. because I don't think a lot of people understand what's going on with the Washington Cares program and the long-term care payroll tax. I think that was evidenced of the vote in November on Initiative 2021-24. If they would have known a little bit more about this, they probably would have said, yeah, let's just make it opt-in. And the people that want it, they can go after it that way. Or even better, people that want long-term care coverage can go out and obtain their own private plan. There's no reason for the state to be getting into this insurance business when there are plenty of options to do this in the private market. So let's talk specifically now about how this might come to fruition, your House Bill 1025. Do you get the sense that any of the fellow Democrats that you have to convince in the legislature to advance this bill, are they supportive of it? Do they recognize the flaws? Or are they just kind of blindly partisan to this because it was Democrats who came up with this Washington Cares program in the first place?
Well, I think both Republicans as well as the ruling party in Olympia recognize the fact that this is a flawed program. And that's evidenced by the number of bills that have been introduced over the last 3 or 4 years, some which have passed, most of them who that didn't, tweak the program, tried to fix the program.
Yeah, it got delayed at one point. Wasn't that something that happened? The start date got delayed?
Yeah.
Because of the confusion?
Because confusion and legislation that was passed that tweaked it a little bit more. And even after all of that, I think there's a recognition that this is not a done deal type program. It is not fully baked, and we still need to make sure that we create a program, if it's going to be permanent, and that's what's going to happen based on the initiative vote, that we make a program that's actually flexible and helps all Washingtonians, not just the few.
Yeah. And then the other, I guess we could call it a companion bill to this. It addresses the same Washington Cares program. The other kind of would acknowledge that, hey, if this all does go into effect as is and stays kind of the same as forced participation, I'll call it, you've got another bill that would be House Bill number 1026 that would allow a person to transfer this long-term care coverage, if they get to the point where they need the coverage, to a spouse.
Yeah, so what 1026 does is it recognizes the fact that it is very hard for people to be vested, especially working families. If you're a mom or dad on paternity leave, or you stay home to take care of kids, you lose your vesting and you have to start all over again. And that's true for anybody who gets hurt at work, seniors who want to go back to work. If there's any of these interruptions that are of any lengthy time, you lose that ability to access any long-term care benefits. So what this says is, if a working spouse is vested and there's another spouse who is not vested, that non-vested spouse would be able to access those benefits. It's also a recognition that we live in a community property state, and if a spouse is not bringing home income to the table and to the household, it's very unfair that the other spouse can't access these benefits, which may or may not be beneficial to them, but they should have access.
Yeah, and how many times do we hear the report that if it's a stay-at-home parent that does child rearing and then oftentimes takes care of so many of the other tasks around the house, the economic impact of all of that, of taking care of kids and taking care of a home and all of those things, they have a significant economic impact, but they just tend to not get measured. And if that's the story for one person's family, then they'd have someone who's stay at home providing all this work and effort to make their house and their home fantastic, but the sheer virtue of not being on a formal payroll means that they're not getting into this benefit that the state is requiring people to do anyway, right?
Yeah, and Washington Cares from day one has failed to recognize that there are a lot of different kinds of families, a lot of different kinds of workers, and people want flexibility. It's not, you know, look, long-term care is important, and I always encourage people to plan on their long-term care.
But right? Yeah,
but there's bigger and better and more efficient ways to do it than this very inefficient, very limited Washington Cares payroll tax. So I'm hopeful that Democrats in Olympia, who rule all all chambers and the governor's office now and have for a generation will recognize that not all families are the same, not all workers are the same, and we need to be flexible.
So, yeah. Peter, this is Mark, and this is great that you're on the air right now and explaining this, because I'm one of these people, and I'm looking at Phil and me and some of the ages of our staff, and, of course, the first thing we heard, okay, this is going to be taken out of our paychecks. We just got paid on Friday. I'm looking at, oh, I contributed more, but apparently we're in that bracket that, well, you'll never get access to it. Are these bills, Peter, that you're sharing and all this information, would this be something that if it did come about, we could just transfer this and it would work for some of us who are on the upper scale of ages? Or is this just something like, no, it'll be an adjustment, but we got a long way to go? What's your confidence level, I guess, on something to help?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know. I don't think this is going to be the last two bills that address some of these issues. But most certainly the other, elephant in the room is there's a lot of workers, one, who will never, ever use this or access it, and they lose it. Or the workers who will continue to contribute but never fully get vested and never have true access to this long-term care planning. Washington Cares gives you this, false confidence that your long-term care needs are going to be met through this program. That is absolutely not true. And $36,500 is a drop in the bucket. It kind of doesn't take care of your long-term care needs, especially if you have something that's going to last over a year.
We're speaking with State Representative Peter Abarno. His legislative district runs from Southern Thurston County, pretty much down the I-5 corridor, Lewis County, Cowlitz County, into Northern Clark County. So he's got a big area that he represents there, kind of southwest Washington. The legislative session starts up January 13th. The big ticket item is going to be how the state handles a projected $10 to $12 billion budget shortfall. What would your priorities be? What things are you going to be looking at accomplishing and prioritizing when the legislative session starts, Representative?
Well, it's an artificial deficit, to be honest, because we have billions of dollars in more revenue in this biennium than we had in the past. This is a spending problem. And so obviously priorities have to be making sure that we invest in building out our tax structure. We need to make sure that we put people back to work and our investments are wise, smart investments, and we don't start spending on programs that haven't even started yet. But generally speaking, I think there's a lot of waste in government. I think there's a lot of efficiencies we can work on, and my priorities would be to invest in people and invest in our economy to create more revenue, not necessarily to sit here and say we have a budget deficit, let's raise taxes on the backs of working Washingtonians. That's the wrong direction. We do not need to raise taxes at any level to get through what is perceived as a budget deficit. We are not in a recession. Our economy is growing, and we need to recognize that.
Yeah. The last couple of minutes of our conversation, we've kind of revolved around two different subjects. One, you just mentioned the spending problems as it relates to the projected budget shortfall, and confusing laws. Why is it that Democrats are so good at producing confusing laws and spending problems? What's going on?
Well, when you've had a Democrat governor for 40 years, control of the House of Representatives for 24, control of the Senate virtually the entire same time, but over the last eight, there's built out this bureaucracy and this messaging monster that will say, hey, there's a deficit, and then everyone just believes there's a deficit without recognizing it's not a deficit. It's an artificial one. So we need to just continue to inform our folks in our districts, our constituents, of the real facts, and shows like yours and the work you're doing is helping us get that message out that we can change Olympia, we can change Washington. We don't have to just sit and accept the status quo.
Yeah, we've got our work cut out for us in that respect. And like I think I mentioned this earlier in the show, we could all benefit from a little bit more critical thinking across the board. State Representative Peter Abarno, Republican in the state legislature, and he's proposing a couple of bills. He's helping co-sponsor a couple of bills that would address the long-term care payroll tax that is known as the Washington CARES program, which was approved by Governor Inslee here a couple years ago and requires everybody to be paying off their payroll, their regular paychecks, to the state program. Thank you very much for your time, Representative, and I'm sure we will reconnect next month when the session's starting up in the legislature, okay?
Anytime. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a wonderful Christmas, New Year, happy holidays. Thank you, Representative Barno.
Same to you. Thank
you. All righty. There's the representative, represents kind of Centralia, Chehalis, Lewis County, Cowlitz County, part of Thurston County, part of Clark County, talking about why we need to make these fixes to the sketchy laws that Governor Inslee and the legislative Democrats keep adding adding on to Washington taxpayers here. All right, Phil Vandervoort in for John Carlson along with Mark Christopher, and I think we got to play the World War II veteran performing the national anthem again. 96-year-old World War II veteran performing the national anthem on musical instrument. That's one of the things we'll do next. Oh, the food bank story. We got to do the food bank story as well. More people going to food banks in Washington because grocery prices are so high. So that's something else that we'll hit next here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. In for John Carlson this morning here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Here's a headline for you. We can get into this story next hour. Scientists may have been wrong about Doomsday Glacier. And it kind of comes back to more or less what we get with these reports, news reports that surface and are attempting to point out that catastrophe is imminent because of climate change, global warming. So the newest story I'll get into more specifics next hour is down in Antarctica, the South Pole. They were talking about imminent collapse of a glacier. Now the scientists are like, okay, we might have been wrong, might have been premature about this. So that's something that we'll hit next hour. And then, of course, the local food bank story. With grocery prices so high in Western Washington, more people are going and relying on food banks. So we'll dig into that story coming up here after the top of the hour. But let's play you the 96-year-old World War II veteran who just performed the national anthem at an NBA ball game. It was the New York Knicks game in New York. Here's 96-year-old Pete Dupre. Harmonica. Celebrate Veterans Day, but shouldn't every day be Veterans Day? That's what I always like to respond to with those things. That's 96-year-old Pete Dupre, national anthem playing harmonica. Fantastic.
Merry New Year!
Happy New Year. In this country, we say Happy New Year.
Ha 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 ha! Thank you for correcting my English with Steve.
Yeah, a little over a week away from Christmas, and then a little over 2 weeks away from New Year's. There's some Eddie Murphy trading places for you here. In for John Carlson this morning. Good morning, everybody. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, joining me.
Last normal week, work week then.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Because the week tomorrow, yeah. Christmas Eve, and then everybody's going to be going from here to there and everywhere.
The holiday, time off, and we'll be taking a few days off next week and all that good stuff, but we'll be back to do the show after Christmas.
But always good content.
Keep you up on the schedule.
When you're on the road headed for your Christmas destination.
Yeah, so no shortage of things that you need to know about that we want to tell you about and discuss with you. And if you've heard something so far this morning you want to share, Hit us up on the KVI text line, 206-421-5757. We'll start checking those text messages, 206-421-5757. I got to say, it's been such a busy morning, jam-packed show so far this morning. I haven't had a chance to look at the text messages yet, so thank you for your patience in that regard. If you missed the interview that we did a half an hour ago with the state representative from Centralia Chehalis, Peter Abarno, on how to improve what we're going to be stuck with regarding Governor Jay Inslee's long-term care payroll tax and the Washington CARES program. The state representative I interviewed is kind of co-sponsoring a couple of bills that are being pre-filed for the legislative session starting next month in Olympia. And they want to try and clarify some of the confusion around the long-term care payroll tax. And this relates to the initiative 2124 on the November ballot last month that was voted down by voters. And I think in a lot of our contention and analysis, it was voted down because it was confusing and that it's a complicated law, complex law, not easy to understand based on this forced participation by paying in a payroll tax. If you missed that interview that I did, we'll get the podcast for today's show posted on KVI.com a little bit later. We usually wrap that up around 11 o'clock noon every morning after the show by the time we get it all produced and set up on the website and everything. And you can hear that for yourself, because if you're concerned about this long-term care payroll tax, if you were bothered that the Initiative 2124 failed at the November ballot because of this flawed law that Democrats and Governor Inslee and the legislature have imposed upon us, you're going to want to hear that. There might, cross your fingers, might be some hope to try and restore some sanity to that whole Washington CARES program. Let's see. We want to get into the local story of the food banks. We've got food banks that are seeing more people, more activity in this state because our grocery prices are so high here. Obviously, cost of living is a whole other problem for the state of Washington and Western Washington in particular. But Como 4 spoke to the CEO at the Food Lifeline. This is the kind of the big coordinator of food bank activity in the state. There are some other, you know, localized groups that handle food bank operations and contributions and donations and all that good stuff. But here's what Como 4 filed. Reporter Stella Sun spoke to the CEO of Food Lifeline about why more people right now in 2024 are going to be going to a food bank than we have in years prior.
You know, as food prices keep going up, Como learned demand has soared, absolutely soared, at local food banks. In fact, as Stella Sun reports this evening, the demand for help is almost as much as it was during the heart of the pandemic.
The price for nearly everything is up. Whether it's the cost of housing or grocery prices, more families are feeling the pinch in their wallets and hunger in their bellies.
One in four Washingtonians are experiencing food insecurity.
Food costs in Western Washington are up by 20% since 2021, according to the U.S. Government Accountability Office. The rise in food prices leading to a rise in families going to the food bank. Last year, the number of visits to local food banks and meal programs was 8 million. Robert Ojeda with Food Lifeline, the largest hunger relief organization in the state, says this year that number is growing. In fact, the number of visits to local food banks and meal programs expected to go from 8 million to 10 million year over year. With more families relying on food banks lately, Ojeda is asking the community to help during the season of giving.
We always welcome volunteers. You know, we have a very generous community here, so your donations financially are really welcome. That really helps us as we work with, you know, the many organizations in our service area.
So there's the Food Lifeline CEO. And so much of this is underscored by, you know, the higher cost of energy in this state to transport goods and things like that to the grocery store. That's driving up the prices at the grocery store. And if people can't afford it at the grocery store, then yeah, their next move is going to be trying to get to a food bank.
Yeah, Robert Ojeda again, Food Lifeline. And he said one in four right now with insecurity here, food insecurity, as he was sharing. And I wonder if there's been change, because I told Phil off air, I have a sister. She got a little health issue going on right now. 20 years right now. She's been helping out at Ballard Food Bank.
Yep.
And she's now living up at Mukilteo. She's been doing some work up there as well, limited on transportation. But she says, Mark, I'm hooked because so many people. And what she says, people off the street just come in and need that little step up. Sometimes it felt they just need it for like 1 week or maybe in between paychecks, just a little meal here and there. But again, you got like, I was doing research. There's 300 food banks and distribution of 72 million pounds of food just around this region as well. I heard Taylor Swift when she did her concerts here, you know, two springs ago. She
donated.
Yeah, she donated to the food banks here. People in the grocery business, has it changed? Last time I talked to people that were stocking shelves, I said a lot of times when the trucks come in with the new food, they take the food close to expiration date, and like bread, and it's tossed out. It's
not
donated to food banks.
I think a lot. I can tell you this. My folks are retired down in University Place, West Tacoma. And this is one of the things that they've been doing on a regular basis in their retirement, helping out at the food bank in University Place. And one of the things they do is they go to the Trader Joe's and they go to a couple of the grocery stores there in that part of West Tacoma, and they gather up what those stores are not going to be able to sell in a timely fashion. And sometimes it's bread, and it just sort of depends. And then they bring that back, and they combine that with all the other donations and
That's good. And
get set up for people that are in need from the food bank.
Yeah, and Karen and I, we kind of like thrift shoppers. Many of you have even more recognized my voice at some of the thrift shops. Like, you sound like a Mark Christopher on the radio. Is that you in a thrift shop? But we do this at grocery stores now because a lot of the prices fill. You see the cereal aisle. You see some of the milk and dairy or whatever. Nobody's buying it like we used to because it's so expensive and people, I just don't need that. Well, now you get close to an expiration date. And what I'm noticing at some of the stores we shop is they'll have an area with, okay, here's the good stuff. Here's that full price you're going to pay for a gallon of milk. But then if you go a couple of rows down, here's the milk that's going to expire or has expired. It's maybe good for another 3 or 4 days and the price is reduced. So then we think,
I'll raise my hand. I've done that a couple of times where I'm at the meat counter.
Right.
And I'm sifting through stuff. And look, here's pork
best
chop.
Used
pork
by
chops reduced.
Or expiration date. And we took
I'll
a chance.
I'll cook them tonight. That's fine. I can do that.
Yeah. And we've been fine with it. You know, is it milk, for example? I've never had any bad milk again. You know, I do my cereal thing or whatever. And I know, okay, I'll be able to use this quart of milk, you know, within a week or whatever. Same thing with bread. Or what have you. Vegetables are another one. So do a little exploration, maybe get to know first name basis with some of those people that work on the shelves and stock them up. And that's a way to save too. But yeah, this food bank thing, good for the volunteers, and that's a biggie. Yeah. They need people. They need volunteers. So, you know, if you're retired or if you're just working part-time and want to get to be a part of the community and feel important, boy, a food bank, that's a way to do it.
Yeah, and I can give some information on that in just a moment, but I want to pick up on kind of what got you going on this from that Como report. 1 in 4 people in the state of Washington struggle with food security. Basically, they flirt with going hungry. And that's what the Governor Inslee legislative majority of Democrats have produced for the state of Washington. And I mean, how many more examples do we need to prove that all of these policies that come out of sometimes King County, to a lesser extent Seattle now, at least Seattle's kind of corrected itself politically, but specifically the legislature in Olympia and Governor Inslee in Olympia, and we end up with 1 out of 4 people that are struggling to get food to eat every day. That's quite a calling card for Governor Inslee. And I can't imagine that any of the policies that are coming with our governor-elect Bob Ferguson are going to be drastically different than what we got from Governor Inslee and the legislative Democrats in Olympia. But there's just sadly another example of how Governor Inslee has made this state worse rather than better in his 12 years in the Olympia legislature. We can continue along with the conversation about the grocery stores and the grocery store prices based on the judges last week blocking the Kroger and Albertsons proposed merger. And I'm looking at a report that cites, I think it's The Atlantic, a writer for The Atlantic named Stacy Mitchell, that basically says that merger was blocked by the President Biden Federal Trade Commission Chair, Lena Khan, And the story says it will likely be her last major action before the Trump administration takes over. And they write Khan stands to be replaced by somebody from the Trump camp. And that this matter may change in the long term, according to Stacey Mitchell for The Atlantic, because the new precedent against mega mergers could be hard to reverse. And I think the summary here is that judges have started to side with, for example, the Biden Federal Trade Commission chair, Lina Khan. And this Atlantic writer writes, the ruling on the Kroger-Albertson case offers the clearest proof yet that the new antitrust movement is breaking through. This merger on the grocery store chains sparked fears of higher grocery prices and closed supermarket stores, captured public attention in a way that few antitrust cases have done so before. And the Atlantic writer writes, judges are people too. They are aware of the debates about corporate power and competition that have been taking place over the last decade. And this argument that this is going to somehow lead to higher prices, it's a little mind-boggling. I think that John Carlson had explained it this way. I'm pretty sure we had this conversation off air, because I know we had it off air, that Walmart, they have the buying power to buy stuff at a lower price, and they can get lower prices on the store shelves than a Safeway Albertsons combination can, or a Kroger can, because Kroger has a bunch of different supermarket stores under different names. There are QFC here in Western Washington. Fred Meyer's also in the Kroger chain. But all over the Midwest, they go by different names. And then they're in California, they're Ralph's and things like that. And the argument was going to be that, hey, if Safeway, Albertsons, and the Kroger chain got together, okay, now they might be on par with the buying power, economies of scale that Walmart might have or Costco might have. And they might be able to offer prices that are more competitive. And sure, yeah, stores are going to close if they merge. But guess what? Stores are probably going to close because they don't merge too. So that's kind of a wash. And then in this Atlantic article, it writes, the author writes, too many people, including judges and the voting public, are looking at the issue with fresh eyes. There were over 100,000 people filing comments on the Kroger-Albertsons merger with the FTC. And labor unions, small businesses, and farmers were uniting against it. And I do think that this all played out as more of a political decision than an economic decision. The labor unions managed to get their Biden supporters, Biden administration supporters, to block this. And I do think that that was one of the turnkey moments in the opposition to this. So perhaps Trump administration comes in, they try and propose this merger again, maybe they make some tweaks to it. There's obviously, if you haven't heard this part of the story, there's a lawsuit between Kroger and Albertsons right now. Albertsons is alleging that Kroger didn't do everything they could have to persuade people to go along with this. But this is just another function of people who don't understand economics.
Well, and you just hit it again. Economics. This goes back on the list of conversations we have in the Christopher household. Like, okay, how's this going to change when we get to the new administration come January? It's got to be a priority because you just think, you know. I mean, people go shopping at certain grocery stores because they'll be, I get points, and then I get discounts if I use the gas and buy the gas from their store. And think about the small.
It's a decent offset, right?
Yeah, think of the small community stores. There's one near where I live over on the peninsula, and it's run by a family. Now, I know if I go there, the gallon of milk is going to be probably $1.50, maybe extra. $2 higher. Yep. But then I'm doing the creative thing, Phil. I'm thinking, okay, how much gas am I going to use? My big pickup, they're driving to town, which is 12 miles round trip, and I'll probably buy some other stuff. But again, you want to support those family operations for the fact of the convenience that maybe they are closer, or maybe they stay open late, even on a holiday. They're open for a few hours because they know you're going to run out of butter on Thanksgiving Day.
The consumer's dilemma.
Yeah. Again, just that support and be creative, and we'll work through this and do our thing. But it has been
and
a
the other
challenge.
Part about high grocery prices, eggs are a big factor right now because of bird flu. and how that's infecting chicken farmers and egg farmers and things like that. Okay, in for John Carlson this morning on a Monday. Thank you for being here with us. We're going to be joined by Young Zach here in a moment. There are a couple of things I got to run by Young Zach, and one of them is this comment from a Boston Globe editorial opinion writer about Gen Z activists, the activist generation of Generation Z. Now, Young Zach is a millennial, but he's pretty close in age to a lot of those Gen Zers. So we're going to hit that coming up here at the bottom of the hour at 8:35. And then I still need to tell you about this story. The headline, scientists may have been wrong about Antarctic glacier melt and what that means for the argument on climate change activism. So those are a couple items. Then we'll hit socialists on social media coming up next. Here's we sit in for Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Uh-oh. Look out.
Why am I thinking this would be in your collection for Christmas songs you just got to have?
You know I am an unabashed AC/DC fan.
Okay, so explain what this is as you see over your shoulder.
So this is not AI, but this, no. You know, this is what AI can produce when you bring two drastically different worlds together, right?
Yeah, AC/DC. Okay. And Brenda Lee. And the song Dirty Deeds around the Christmas tree. So a bit of a mashup here on these two songs. It's not AI, but I'm finding some examples. Like some of you were telling me, Mark, did you hear that like the Beatles have a Christmas album now? Right. It's AI. But I got to show you how good some of this stuff is.
So strictly speaking, this is what we call a mashup, where you take two
There's
different
Brenda
songs,
Lee, and you
mix
the guitar
them
part.
Together, and you get a whole new wacky combination, and that's where you get Bon Scott and Brenda Lee. And happy holidays, Christmas, happy Festivus for the rest of us, to everybody out there. We're in for John Carlson this morning. Phil Vandervoort here, Mark Christopher over there. John's just taking a couple of days off. He'll be back on Thursday. Young Zach's going to join us in the next segment. He's always running the show for us on Thursdays and Fridays. I have two items I got to run by Young Zach. We need that millennial perspective on a couple of stories. We'll get that here after the bottom of the hour traffic check. So let's get to social media. From Socialists, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This one comes by way of the website Semaphore that does a lot of politics. And it cites the Kamala Harris presidential campaign's digital chief talked openly about how Democrats are losing hold of culture and kind of how Democrats in this presidential election cycle just didn't manage to tap into people who don't really care about politics until it comes time to deal with going out to vote or filling out that mail-in ballot. And the Semaphore story says, soon after Vice President Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee, the deputy campaign manager, Rob Flattery, turned his attention to sports. The campaign needed to introduce VP Harris quickly to people who just don't care about politics, aren't obsessed with politics, and don't pay attention to politics. And sports is perhaps America's last remaining monoculture, writes Semaphore. And Flaherty and the Harris team decided to book her on sports shows and podcasts to try and get that crossover identification. But one by one, the biggest personalities and shows politely turned down the Harris campaign. And the campaign guy trying to do this for Kamala Harris said, sports and culture have sort of merged together, and as sports and culture became more publicly and sort of natively associated with the Trump campaign or Trump conservative voters, it got more complicated for athletes to come out in favor of Kamala Harris. And Flaherty from the campaign for Kamala Harris said it got more complicated for sports personalities to take us on their shows because they didn't want to, quote, do politics. And Flaherty declined to say who turned down the Harris campaign for these types of interviews, but she didn't appear on key shows that are hosted by sports figures that are sympathetic to Democrats. She did appear on a couple of sports-based podcasts hosted by former players, one former NBA players, one former NFL player, Shannon Sharp. So they got some exposure that way, but apparently they didn't get interviews set up. And there's another example of how Kamala Harris either just couldn't connect with, couldn't cross over, or just wasn't compelling enough for anybody else to want to support her campaign for president. So there's that. I got to tell you still about the scientists who are now saying they may have been wrong about an Antarctic glacier down on the South Pole, and it's maybe not as in apocalyptic shape as they made it out to be. So we'll get that story to you. And then the state of Washington is getting all kinds of money for electric vehicles, but the Associated Press just posted a story that says in Nigeria's lithium boom, because you got to have lithium for these lithium-ion batteries that EVs use, many mines are illegal and children do much of the work. So what kind of impact is that having on this push for electric vehicles? That's another story we'll get into as we sit in for John Carlson here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. 2.5 hours into the show, I need to make a correction. Earlier on the show, I was sitting in for John Carlson this morning. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. And I crisscrossed the names of the generations, Gen Z and millennials, and I had it backwards. The millennials are the older, the Gen Z are the younger. And we were talking about this in relation to the arrest of Luigi Mangione, planned to be charged or expected to be charged with the assassination murder of the United Healthcare CEO, Brian Thompson. And this disturbing aspect that many younger people are either praising or are cool with the possibility, the allegation that Luigi Mangione basically shot and killed Brian Thompson on the street in New York City. So we were talking about that a little bit earlier, and this comment that came up in an interview clip from Fox Business News with Charles Payne, one of the Fox Business hosts over there, and he was interviewing a writer, an opinion editorial board member, opinion writer for the Boston Globe news website in Boston. It's the conservative news outlet there in the city of Boston. And the gal you're going to hear, her name is Corinne Hajjar, and she was talking about how Gen Z is an activist generation. And we've got young Zach here who helps run the show. The Carlson Show on Thursdays and Fridays is with us. Hi, Zach. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I wanted to run this past you and have you react to a little bit of what she's saying about Gen Z being the activist generation, particularly as it relates to politics. Here's the clip.
It's an activist generation, and I think that in a lot of cases this year, we've seen activism just go too far, whether it's anti-capitalist activism like this last instance, or if we're talking about posters, what about ripping down posters of hostages held in Gaza? I mean, it is just an activist generation that will say or do anything to justify their ideology.
Is there an element of truth to what this writer from Boston is saying?
Of course. I think she went a little light just bringing up posters. I mean, think of everything that happened back
then.
Yeah,
we had the occupation on the campuses earlier this year.
All over the country. Yeah. Columbia, UW, everywhere. All these, UCLA. It's beyond vandalism. It's just flat out decimating all these different campuses and stuff like that. And then take it even back to 2020, with the BLM riots and stuff like that, looting, and everyone just said,
defund police movement,
all that sort of stuff. People just said, it's just protest. It's extreme protest. No, it's crime.
Yeah. Now, you are certainly a little bit closer in this to experience and proximity than I am as a 55-year-old. So I'll ask you the question that I was kind of theorizing on a little bit earlier in the show. Where did this activism come from? What is this influence on these teens and 20-somethings that prompts them to have reactions like this to the murder of a United Healthcare CEO?
I think it probably stems from the same thing that any protest or any sort of activism comes from. The difference, I think, is that the online generation has such a difficult time separating real life from fake life. None of this stuff is real to anybody, and these lines get blurred. You know, you harass someone on social media.
It's not real when it's on social media.
Exactly.
It's something intangible.
And I think that's where, all the support for Luigi, I don't think is real, when it comes down to it. I think it's online support. It's fake support.
Something people say when they can just tap it in on their keyboard.
Yeah, because it's easy and it's harmless in their eyes.
Uh-huh. I think you might be onto something there as well, that just because I posted it on this social media platform doesn't really mean that I believe it. Almost.
Yeah, and the same goes for the donations to his legal fund and stuff. You throw $20 of your, I mean, you're not opening your wallet and putting $20 into a red kettle outside of a Fred Meyer. You're moving fake numbers from your fake bank account and your fake Zelle whatever, and you send it off to this thing that you don't actually. You're not showing up at the courthouse and supporting.
Yeah, physically taking it out of your pocket.
You're not looking the family in the eyes and saying, "No, I stand with Luigi." That's not. Yeah. You know, no one's thinking like that.
Well, I was telling Phil over the weekend here the fact that GoFundMe now has gone online, saying there was so many GoFundMe campaigns that were underway for Luigi Mangione that they put a stop. They said we're shutting these all down, but like. Just what you're sharing here, it's like, was there really any proof that these things were growing fast and a lot of donations, or was it like you said, just reaction, just people wanting to do something, enough to get the attention now of GoFundMe saying, okay, nothing, no GoFundMe allowed for this shooting incident that happened in New York with the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other reasons I wanted to bring in Young Zach is because I have a dilemma. This is something that I've been witness to the last couple of weekends watching ball games. And the commercial keeps coming up. And I've heard about this technology for a while now. This is about a new vehicle, car that's essentially an SUV. It's a truck. And it seems really cool, but I don't get it. And so I know Zach is a car guy. I like to think I'm a car guy. Mark, you drive a big 3/4-ton pickup truck sometimes. You have that in your garage for the things that you do with your family. The new GMC Hummer has the crab walk feature, and the commercials look really cool. But I've seen this for a couple of weeks now, if not longer, but it seems like it's ramped up here the last couple of weeks where I'm seeing this commercial almost every time I'm tuning into a ball game, and I don't get the crab walk. It looks cool, but what is it for?
Well, it's for soccer fans. It's for soccer fans who can't park.
Is it for parallel parking? Is that it? Is that primarily what
it's
for?
Well, you can't do it going down the highway.
Is it for off-roading?
No, it's just parallel park. You can't go crab walk at 60 miles an hour.
More specifically for that. But I thought we had cars that could back themselves up and park themselves now with the onboard cameras and
I think this can park in a smaller spot because you don't need any room.
Right, that's always a trick.
Whether or not a computer's, you know, like I think the Teslas were the first ones to kind of self-park themselves to the parallel park. And I think that the crab walk, you just need exactly the width of your vehicle.
All right. I've just...
But I think the Fiats are doing it too, I think I saw.
Fiats up to this?
Yeah, I believe so.
Those cars are itty-bitty.
If there's anything no one asked for, it's an electric Fiat.
Okay.
Well, and you bring up a point too. And again, okay, I'm going to show my age, everybody. Uh-huh. A lot of these cars. My daughter just got a newer car. Look, Dad, it's the keyless kind of car. All you got to do is just make sure you got the fob.
Yeah, right.
You push button, start, whatever. And I was with, let's say, another driver in the family close to my age, and we just took a road trip up to Port Townsend, which, boy, there's a fun destination every time if you got some family here. Mm-hmm. And he's got his first car with cruise control. And I'm like, okay, it's raining. We got some puddles here on the highways over on Hood Canal. Why are you using cruise control? Oh, that's great. It's great. I go, what if we hit a puddle? I mean, we say this on radio. You could be in a spin in no time. We hit some dry area, and he's telling me, he goes, well, have you heard about the advanced cruise control? I go, what's that? And he goes, well, I have a graph here on my dash that you can adjust so that when you're cruising along, if you get behind a slow truck, it will detect that slow truck and take over the brake.
The avoidance.
And I'm like, no, you need to touch the brake. And I said, there's got to be a flaw. And he goes, well, yeah. He says, I found out that when the car does that and it reads like we're getting behind a slow truck going up a hill and the car slows down, apparently my brake lights don't come on.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, so we're asking for a rear end for somebody who just suddenly decides to go to their cell phone for a peek. I'm like, oh, my gosh, the car in front of me behind that truck just slowed down. This technology is coming too quick, and I'm like, it's a privilege to drive. You know, if you're in the air and you're a pilot, automatic pilot, I can see, but when it comes to landing and takeoff, you got to take over. But for a car on a road with cars all around you, and you're going to put this thing in automatic mode and sit back, and I think I'll read a little book here because this thing will drive by itself. Scary.
Yeah, that is the future, though. I mean, the auto pilot driving, that is the way of the future.
I've seen some of these people driving. You're in your car right now. You're looking around. I don't think it's that scary. I'll take the computer.
Right. I always thought that, if you can't parallel park the vehicle, maybe you shouldn't be driving the vehicle was my other concern about these automated parallel parking conditions or programs that the newer vehicles have. But I love the crab walk. Looks great. I just couldn't understand what are you using it that much? If anybody's got one of the Hummers that has the crab walk capability, would love a text message about what you use it for, how often you get to use it, that sort of thing. And certainly if you've taken it off road.
And text us again when it breaks.
Okay. We'll get that subsequent text message.
As the Northwest Auto Show would say, report back.
Report back. That's a Saturday show.
Because I can only imagine these things. You're going to parallel park and crab walk. You're going to go to leave. It's going to be stuck, and you're going to be like going down the road sideways to the shop.
All righty. Slow drive to the shop in crab walk mode. All right. The text message number, 206-421-5757. And we've got a bunch. We can kind of get to some from earlier in the show. Again, the text number, 206-421-5757. We were talking about the drone situation earlier, and somebody pointed out, wait a minute, I think you just glossed over something there. Some law is about to expire giving Department of Homeland Security and FBI ability to deal with drones, and we have this manufactured drone hysteria. Timing. Something suspect there, writes Rob in 425. And let's see, there's another one about the drones. Hey, Phil, one story is that New Jersey and other drones could be checking for nuclear, biological, radiological threats. So that's another comment right there. Somebody says that the city of Cedro Woolley has the right to take down drones based on a Facebook post that they linked to. We were talking about some of the healthcare stuff. A little bit earlier, my suggestion was, because if Democrats are going to try and push for Medicare for all and universal health care or single-payer health care, I was saying it seems like things end up working better when employers provide health care for employees. And my suggestion was, hey, tax break for the companies and the employers that do that. Anonymous conservative in Seattle, who's kind of a regular texter, wrote, getting rid of Obamacare is the most important thing that Trump needs to be doing. If he punts on it this time as president, I think it's over and the socialists have won. Jonathan Gruber planned on the stupidity of the American voter for the socialist takeover, and so far it's working exactly as planned. I think there was an addition to this comment. Let me see if I can pull that up. And he writes, as an employer who's paid for my employees' health insurance for over the last three decades, I promise you, there is no polishing this turd that will save it. Trump has to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, in its entirety this time, or we'll have government health care within a decade. It's completely unworkable now, way too expensive, and the options for small companies, like I was pointing out, are absolute crap. So there's a little bit more response from the text line, and I'll continue to check the text messages, and I'll tell you about this Antarctica glacier that apparently is not as in dire straits as all the scientists were warning about as it relates to global warming. So that's another thing that's coming up if we wrap up this morning's show. In for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
You know, before I get into the next story, Phil, this is pretty cool because I was seeing over the weekend here the fact that the U.S. Coast Guard Heli is back. Came back in on Saturday here, early hours here, 2.5 months up north in the Arctic. And as they go up there, there's military personnel, civilian scientists, civilian personnel to go up and do lots and lots of research.
Yep.
And I think it's fitting with this next story. I'd love to hear what they say, what you're about to share.
So my story that I was going to wrap up with is about the Antarctic and a glacier that's called the Doomsday Glacier, but I think maybe the better way to explain it would be Canary in the Coal Mine. And the story I've got, a headline from Newsweek says, scientists may have been wrong about Antarctic glacier. And the recent study has challenged some of the most alarming predictions that were made about the Antarctica Thwaites Glacier. And it was dubbed the Doomsday Glacier owing to the seismic impacts it could have on the world's oceans. So the research now suggests that a catastrophic collapse of the glacier is less likely to occur this century than previously thought. So, good news, right? And I guess the other way to look at it is that previous studies and/or reports overstated or didn't have an accurate grasp on what might be happening with this glacier in Antarctica. The Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica has been a major focus for climate scientists due to its unstable nature and significant contribution to global sea level rise. So in short, the findings offer a glimmer of hope and growing concerns about the impacts of climate change on the Antarctic. And it was published in Science Advances, and led by researchers at Dartmouth College. The study reevaluated a process known as marine ice cliff instability. And marine ice cliff instability, in case you're wondering, it does have its own acronym, like almost every other government procedure, MICI, M-I-C-I. So I think the short answer here is, all right, either previous study overstated things or new study produced new information that said, oh, we were wrong about our previous study.
And how many years have we been hearing about this, Phil? Yeah. Oceans are going to rise just a few feet here and there, and it's going to change the whole world.
Yeah.
And there's no stopping. And then suddenly you tune in, and look what Phil just shared.
In the remaining time that we have on this morning's show, as we sit in for John Carlson, John's just out today, tomorrow, Wednesday. He'll be back on Thursday. So we'll put the band back together for Thursday and Friday's show, and we'll all be here next Monday before we kind of take some respective timeouts for Christmas and we'll give you the schedule here later in the week for the days we're going to be on here as we go through Christmas and New Year's. But I'll get into this tomorrow on the show as we sit in for John. It all revolves around electric vehicles. Channel 7, Cairo 7 TV, is reporting that the state of Washington is going to get $8.4 million to buy 28 electric vehicles. Now, you're thinking, okay, that is $300,000 per vehicle, but a lot of these are going to be larger vehicles. Mostly buses, one garbage truck. So we'll get into that. And I know that Governor Inslee, all the Democrats in the legislature, Democrats across King County, they don't like carbon fossil fuel emissions. They don't like cars that are running on gasoline and diesel. They want EVs, right? So the state of Washington is going to get money from the Biden administration for EVs, mostly for school buses. Simultaneously, there is a brand new report by the Associated Press that says in Nigeria, lithium mining, you need lithium for electric vehicle batteries. Many mines are illegal and children do much of the work. So how is Jay Inslee going to reconcile all of that? That is something that we will get into on tomorrow's show as we sub for John Carlson. Markley Van Camp and Robbins are up next at 9. And then Lars Larson at noon. Ari Hoffman at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on Talk Radio 570 KVI.